we talk about, and we talk very much about the international civil servant, this idea that the Secretary General, the UN personnel are independent, autonomous, and that they serve the world community, the UN, the world organization. This idea is something that Dag Hammarskjöld had with him from his youth, actually. His father was a very prominent civil servant in Sweden. He was a professor of law and he was in the government. But he's also a very conservative person. And I don't think the idea of what Dag really did appeal to him. I mean, because Dag Hammarskjöld became a civil servant first to the Social Democratic government in Sweden and then to the UN. So I think he took the ideals of his father, this idea of the independent civil servant, which was a quite conservative idea, but he gave it a different content, so to speak. And I think in some ways he was sort of radicalized by his experiences because, you know, the reason people talk about him in Zambia, of course, is that he became very engaged in the process of decolonization. I don't think that was something that he, you know, would have thought he would be engaged in when he was, you know, back in Sweden, but he realized that this was the big issue, this was what the UN had to do. So he saw it as his mission to help these newly formed states, independent states, to become functioning members of the UN. That's what he saw as his mission, basically. So therefore I think that he has a special relationship to all former colonized countries, but I think Africa especially, because that's where it happened.
What would you say in the book highlights some of the most defining moments of his life?
You know, the most famous one, I guess, well, besides what happened in Congo, of course, I think, is the Suez Crisis. I mean, that's the exciting historical moment. And when he confronts difficulties, but also solves them, I mean, he works. The story is that he actually doesn't sleep for a week when the Security Council is dealing with the Suez. And it's full of conflicts because the French and the British and the Israelis have gone behind the back of the UN and sent troops to the canal, which the Egyptians have nationalized. And they're playing a very devious game. They're hoping that the UN would sanction this afterwards, because then, you know, in their view, Nasser is stopping international trade through the Suez Canal. It isn't closed, though, but they dislike the whole idea. And the former colonial powers are furious over Nasser. And it is a problem, of course, but Hammarskjöld really sort of sees it that this is not what the UN is about. I mean, when member states attack each other without warning, this is the whole point of the UN is stopping these things. So he gets very engaged, he gets furious with the French and the British, feels deceived by them. He has support of the Soviet Union, but also the United States, which is very important at that moment. And he takes it to the General Assembly and he gets the mandate to get the peacekeeping troops, create the peacekeeping force, which I think is one of those, you know, signature moments in the US history. Of course, you know, we can see that there are lots of problems now with peacekeeping, definitely. But it's at that moment when, as it's been put, it's a cliche, but the secretary becomes general. And these troops are recruited mainly from, you know, the smaller countries, the non-aligned countries, as opposed to the big powers. So it gives the UN a new kind of stance in the world. So that's the most famous moment, but there are lots of moments. But he's very good at using the charter and finding maneuvering room. So that's one part of it. The other part is a sort of action-oriented, of going off and meeting these, you know, going to the conflict areas. And in the 50s, people get used to this idea that if there's a conflict, as they say, leave it to Dag, right? That's the phrase. And, you know, you get used to seeing Dag Hammarskjöld flying in and, you know, coming out of the airplane in his white suit and his bow tie and, you know, looking very much like the reserved Swedish gentleman, and then going down and maybe there's some UN troops there, and then, you know, going off and meeting those people who are in conflict and getting them together in negotiations. So that's the image of Dag Hammarskjöld. And I think that's important because it gives the world a certain hope. Some of it, it's overstated and it's too much. Dag Hammarskjöld is not going to save the world, but it is... gives optimism in the sense that there's a person who people trust to be honest, fair, and try to negotiate difficult conflicts. That's very hopeful to the world.
There are a lot of similarities between when he became Secretary General and the times that we're living in now. What can you share with us about that time?
When he comes in, I mean, the UN is actually in dire straits because the Russians are not recognizing the Secretary General, who's Trygve then. They're boycotting the Security Council. The Korean War has been going on, so there's been a war going on between the capitalism and communism, what do you want to say? So the UN is not in a very good shape when he comes in. Now, of course, in a way, he's lucky, because what happens then is that you get, and this is 1953, and Stalin has died, the Korean War has ended. There are these years in the middle 50s when actually Khrushchev and the Russians are quite positive in cooperating. So he gets maneuvering space. But he uses this, as you say, very much to reform the UN. And what he does very much is to higher the standards of integrity very much. Of course, the UN is much smaller then. We're talking about 4,000 people that he's leading. But I mean, the signals he sends to them, both in terms of his own actions as General Secretary, but also in terms of how he defends them, their integrity. Because, for instance, I mean, the FBI is inside the UN building at that time. And this is because of the McCarthyism in the US. And he managed to throw them out fairly rapidly after becoming Secretary General, which I think gains him really the confidence of the staff of the UN that this is the Secretary General who's going to stand up for them. So he accomplished these things. What that means in the world today, it's hard to say. I mean, I don't know how many employees there are, but I mean, the UN is a much larger organization. It's much more difficult. The world is more multipolar. I mean, at that time, if you got the Soviets and the Americans online, then the UN could function. And, you know, especially if you got them to sort of put down the old colonial powers, you know, we're in a totally different place there now.
There's a lot written about his life, but there's a lot of speculation about his death, too.
I've avoided his death because, not because I think it's unimportant, of course, to find out what happened, but it tends to get in the way of the life. We become too obsessed. I mean, we've seen this so many times, you know. John F. Kennedy, you know, the whole assassination obscures whatever he did or didn't do. I mean, we're not sure he actually was a great president. I mean, he doesn't become a great president just because he was assassinated. And, you know, Hammarskjöld's merits stand not on being, you know, the manner of his death, but rather the way he lived his life. That said, of course, it is a very, the circumstance, and you used to talk just about Zambia and Northern Rhodesia, as it was at that time. And, you know, it was really an intense area of conflict. You can't disprove that it was an accident. I mean, there's no evidence that shows that clearly that it was not an accident. But of course, I can understand the speculations because there were so many people who were upset about Hammarskjöld. He was so disliked by everybody at a certain point there because on the one hand, you know, the colonials hated him because they thought he was, you know, helping Congo shut down Katanga, the separatist movement there. Other African states who supported him were disappointed that he wasn't taking more resolute actions. On the other hand, the British and the French and the Belgians and the United States really disliked him for, you know, going too far in Katanga. So he was sort of walking a tightrope there. So there were, you know, very many people who disliked him, and you had, you know, the white supremacists or whatever you want to call them in Rhodesia, who were scared totally out of their minds by getting a functioning Congo. They didn't want Congo to become a viable state, basically. So there were lots of people who were interested in stopping him in some ways. That does not prove that he was killed.
What do you want people to take away from this book?
Hammarskjöld combined two things which are very rare to find in one person. And that's, on the one hand, this really sort of very strong respect for the rule of law. You know, nothing he did was arbitrary. I mean, everything has to be grounded in some kind of, not a law, but in the UN Charter, in, you know, a common agreement of some kind. He was not a solo actor in that sense. But on the other hand, once he had that mandate, he was very bold in what he did. I mean, he would sort of just pop off and take a risk and meet somebody like the rebel leader in Katanga or Zhou Enlai in China or whatever. I mean, some of these missions were risky in a, you know, physical sense. Some were just risky because he was taking a diplomatic risk. You have to sort of learn from them. Those things are needed. We're not going to get a new Hammarskjöld, and I'm not even sure we need a new Hammarskjöld. I mean, he lived in a very different world. I mean, it was a very elitist, male-oriented, still very colonial world. I mean, a lot of things have happened that are good since then. So the world is not run by white Europeans as it was in Hammarskjöld's time, but you can still learn from his way of being a Secretary General.